What do you know about the American Revolution? According to our guest today, the mother's milk of the revolution really was commerce. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
What is America really all about? It has always been the case that, at least aspirationally, America is about that if we work hard and play by the same rules that apply equally to all, we can get ahead. At least that's the intent. That is part of it. The truth is, there's a rather distinct dividing line in American history, the America before President Lincoln and the new and very different one that he envisioned after the Civil War. But as we know all too well, we remain a long way off from his then radical expressed aspiration of equal justice for all. In the 2020s, there's talk, especially regarding the Supreme Court, of returning to the original intent of America's founders. People on both sides of the aisle may insist they know the original intent and that their vision is the correct one. If we'd only get back to that. Well, as with so much actual history, a lot of people are in for a big surprise. Could it be as simple as what my beloved history professor at college said, the founding fathers were in part motivated by the desire for a bigger share of the loot that had been all going to England? According to our guest on Keeping Democracy Alive today, Professor John O. McGinnis, my professor was not exactly right, but not entirely wrong either. It was patriotism, too. Professor McGinnis's article appeared in Law and Liberty magazine, which brings together serious debate, commentary, essays, book reviews, interviews, and educational material in a commitment to examining the first principles of a free society as they appear in law, history, political thought, and other aspects of culture. And the magazine is provided by Liberty Fund, Incorporated, a private educational foundation established to encourage the study of the ideal of a society of free and responsible individuals. McGinnis' article is titled The Mother's Milk of Revolution, and it caught my eye as it discusses a new book by Willard Randall titled The Founder's Fortunes, How Money Shaped the Birth of America. The book shows that right from the beginning, a commercial spirit and the wealth it generated were essential to creating and constituting America. The America we traditional liberals have always wanted to believe was there from the beginning was perhaps not. Maybe it was. It is really more nuanced and inclusive, as history goes. Our guest argues that one can be both patriotic and firmly dedicated to protecting commerce. The tension in the quest for economic fairness and capitalism has never been smooth. Since the 18th century, the Shays and Whiskey Rebellions, there's been a populist movement to, instead of rich white men unquestionably ruling, to one of fairness across the economic spectrum. Lincoln may have envisioned it, but boy, we still have a long way to go toward what he called a more perfect union. To see where we're trying to go, it is essential that we see how we got here. That's the intent of the upcoming discussion. John O. McGinnis is the George C. Dix Professor in Constitutional Law at Northwestern University and a contributing editor at Law and Liberty. His book, Accelerating Democracy, was published by the Princeton University Press in 2012. They do have a lot of good books. McGinnis was also co-author of Originalism and the Good Constitution. He's a graduate of Harvard College, Balliol. I should know that. Sorry, Oxford and Harvard Law School. He's published in leading law reviews, including the Harvard, Chicago, and Stanford Law Reviews and the Yale Law Journal, and in journals of opinion, including National Affairs and the National Review. And he's working on a new book, Why Democracy Needs the Rich. Long introduction. Thank you, Professor McGinnis, for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
You write that right from the beginning, a commercial spirit and the wealth it generated were essential to creating and constituting America, end of quote. This analysis goes against an idealistic picture that many have soothingly embraced for decades. Why is it important to get this out there in these rather interesting times?
The one, I guess, caveat I would have, I'm not quite sure I see commercialism as opposed to idealism just at least at that time, because the idea of commercial was really juxtaposed against the idea of a feudal society. And at least at that time, a commercial society was seen to be a movement to, in fact, was a foundation of what was understood to be a liberal society then, because what mattered was not your birth, but the way you participated in commerce. And of course, that meant serving other people by giving them something of what they wanted. And so I think commerce was actually part of the ideals. If you go back to Montesquieu, for instance, who's one of the first modern political theorists, he talks about the virtues of commerce in a society that go beyond simply creating wealth. Mm-hmm. He says it actually makes people behave better towards one another because they have an interest in perhaps getting wealthy from one another and making deals. It's not a zero-sum game. He thinks that actually commercial societies are less likely to fight because they also have opportunities to trade and make each other better off. Commerce, at least at that time, was thought to be by many an ideal of society that was very well geared to taking human nature as it was and promoting both a more pacific and a more wealthy and a more kind of congenial society. So that may or may not be true. Those are empirical claims. But I think the commercial society was bound up with some very high ideals at the time.
And certainly a far cry from life being short, nasty, and brutish of the feudal times that preceded it. So interesting that there was some idealism in that, and it does make a lot of sense. And as you note in your essay, there have been innumerable biographies of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. They were all important, for sure, but there's a name very few have heard of, without whom, and people like him, you say the revolution would have failed. I'm referring to Robert Morris. Tell us, please, about who he was and his role in making the revolution successful.
Robert Morris was, most historians believe, the wealthiest person in the United States at the time. He was at the time of the Revolution. He was from Pennsylvania, and he was crucial in a variety of ways to the success of the Revolution. For instance, at times, the Revolution had problems just because they didn't have enough money, and no one really credited the credit, as it were, of the United States. After all, the United States was, or the colonies together, were fighting against the most powerful nation in the world. They might not succeed. So why would you actually want to lend them any money?
Yeah,
and
really,
yet you need to, pardon?
Yeah, I was just agreeing. Yeah, it'd be sort of a little risky venture.
A little risky. And so he used his personal credit to supply the army at times. Then he, but beyond his personal credit, he used his knowledge. He was very key in founding what was called the Bank of North America, which is in some sense our first national bank. We talk about the Bank of the United States, founded in the early Republic, and but this was even earlier than that, and that was very important for some of the same reasons the Bank of the United States was important. It allowed money to be more easily moved around. It allowed for credit. What it did was it bought up a lot of worthless, pretty worthless currency called the Continentals, and backed it, the new currency, with some money that they got from France, and that enabled the payment of soldiers. And of course, it's important to be able to pay your soldiers. So he was really very important. He was a superintendent of finance, and therefore, in some sense, the crucial linchpin of logistics for a good deal of the revolutionary period. So he's an unsung hero of the revolution, a person working behind the scenes, not actually fighting in any battles, but as many generals have observed, battles are actually won on logistics, and you needed money to supply the army.
Now, one thing I've discovered from looking at a lot of different histories, including, as regular listeners know, the First World War, the control of the money and being able to lend money to a belligerent exceedingly important. People don't see that very much, but it's big, big factor. And you say that during the struggle for independence in 1781, American finances became, in your word, rickety. What do you mean by that? Tell us about that.
Well, it became rickety because they issued a lot of currency, the Continentals, and people were, for some of the reasons I've discussed before, they were fighting the war, were not at all sure that this money would be worth anything at the end. And so it therefore depreciated. That was, I think, a crucial problem. And I think there was some pretty substantial inflation, therefore, in the Continentals. So people were not, I think, eager to take them. If you're less eager to exchange, if you think the money's not going to be worth as much. And that's one of the reasons that Morris establishes the Bank of the United States, to try to put the currency and the finances of the revolution on a sounder basis.
I can imagine the British side wasn't crazy about that. They were, they had been a colonial power, an imperial power for decades, and had significant, their investment in England was rock solid, but it up until Robert Morris, I guess it was, as you say, a little bit rickety. But that made a huge, huge difference to make the money actually worth something, and people know that they were going to get their value. And one of the signers of the Declaration that everybody knows, of course, is Boston's John Hancock. You can picture his signature right in the top of your head. Everybody knows what it looks like, but that's about it. Tell us about his role, John Hancock's role as financier.
Well, John Hancock, if Robert Morris was the wealthiest person in America, John Hancock was probably the wealthiest person in Massachusetts. He was both a politician and a very wealthy merchant. He had largely inherited a fortune from his uncle. And he used that money in very concrete ways to advantage the revolution. He raised a regiment. So that meant he supplied a regiment with uniforms and muskets. And so that regiment was really in the field because of his fortune. He was not an officer of the regiment. He didn't have those abilities. But again, it's an example of how he was essential to getting people in the field. He was also very important, oddly enough, in even getting people to the Continental Congress. Sam Adams, who's probably in some sense more famous now than John Hancock, was a revolutionary, but an extremely poor one. And so Hancock spirited him off to Philadelphia in his coach, even bought him a suit of clothes so he would look more respectable in the Continental Congress. So it was a good example of what happened in the American Revolution and some other revolutions as well, of a kind of marriage between ideologists, of whom Sam Adams was, who was a kind of propagandist, and the people who could, in some sense, facilitate the dissemination of the ideas, people with resources, someone like John Hancock.
Well, yeah, it's nice if it works. You know, without that capital, it's kind of difficult to make it work. What was then Great Britain, it's not so great now, was said to have ruled the waves. And indeed, they did. The ocean between England and America is huge. Given this reality, how big a problem was it that there was simply no American Navy? The way the British Navy financed itself is little known, and the colonists took a cue from that. You say, amusingly, privatizing the Navy also showed the American dream was at work, even in those early troubled times, and that the sailors transformed themselves from hired hands into wartime capitalists. That sounds like an interesting story. Do tell, how did the sailors make this transformation?
It happened again. It happened, but first it was people with capital, because again, the idea of a Navy was to outfit ships that would essentially be investment ventures, because the idea of the ships would be to interdict, to stop British ships, to capture them. And at that time, what you could do is then sell what was called a prize, and therefore get money for the investors in the ship and for the crew as well. They were as often in a partnership. They're the people who bring the capital, it's the people who bring the labor. But in this case, the people who brought the labor were the seamen. And so they were paid off also through the prizes. And this was the way the United States essentially countered the powerful British Navy and essentially prevented their merchant marines from simply supplying their army at a very high rate. The way this was connected to the American dream was the people who were the laborers at the time sometimes came into a big prize. They had a voyage where they caught a lot of British ships, and then they were paid off their share of the profits, and then they could start to invest in other ships themselves. And so this shows how they moved from being a laborer to a capitalist. Because I dare say to encourage or to get labor on these risky voyages, you had to promise a decent share of the profits, because in fact, economists show there's a premium if you go on a enterprise which might result in death, which of course privateering could.
It did have some risks, that's for sure. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Professor John O. McGinnis, who is a professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University, contributing editor at Law and Liberty, talking about an article he wrote called The Mother's Milk of the Revolution. It's a little bit different perspective, more inclusive perspective of the American Revolution. And it's fairly well known that General George Washington had a difficult time with the rabble that made up his command. We like to think of our founders, the warriors, as heroic idealists who did what they did out of a deep sense of patriotism, which maybe they did, but was that generally the case? What about the situation with Washington and his rabble that he had a hard time with?
Well, I certainly came away from this book with no lower opinion of Washington. What I do think this book emphasizes is that, in addition to being a general and a, of course, our first president, and still in some people's views our greatest president, he and Lincoln generally contend for that honor, he was a businessman. He was business-minded from the beginning. It's important to recognize that Washington was not born to great wealth. While he was born in Virginia, he was not born, unlike Jefferson, to one of the great plantation families. And so right from the beginning, he was a surveyor and earned a good deal of money when he was, I think, 16, 17, before he went off and fought in the French and Indian Wars. And right through his career, he was always looking create for himself, and I think for the nation as a whole, better mechanisms of commerce. And so at the after the Revolution, I think one of the most interesting stories told in this book is he sets up the Potomac Company to essentially create hopes to create a canal to the west, because there are a lot of opportunities to settle in the West and to create a larger republic, again, showing how commerce is really bound up with the growth of the nation. And he's essential to that. And the problem is that states, which still have a lot of autonomy at the time, are squabbling over who's going to get the revenues from these canals. Essentially, Virginia and Maryland are squabbling. And he tries to settle that. And out of that meeting comes a view that, well, maybe we actually need to settle this more generally and have a constitutional convention to have a structure where states aren't going to squabble about commerce, and we can actually have better national trade and better national improvements, of course, like this canal that he envisions. So that shows, again, that commerce and what we might call political ideals are not so divided. It's really this commercial enterprise that's one of the catalysts for our Constitution. And also to make the point that he's not just in it for himself. I think he agrees that the money he makes from this Potomac company is going to donate to charity. So he's there's no doubt that while Washington is someone who's interested in bettering himself, he's also interested in bettering the country. Incidentally, one of the most interesting facts which happens very early in the book is that he's very happy to get the salary as president because, like many landowners, he's land poor and doesn't have a lot of cash and was going to have to start selling off things unless he got a salary. And interestingly, the salary he got in today's terms was extremely high. $750,000 is what the author thinks is the equivalent today. That's much more than a president, of course, is paid today. I think it's around $400,000, $450,000. But for the time, it's just a huge salary. And that's something I think we should think a bit of. May we pay our public servants too little. I know that in Singapore, for instance, they pay them a great deal more, and their government is thought to be extremely efficient and well-run. And certainly, just as with everything, you're likely to elicit maybe a stronger group of people if you pay them more. And that's one of the things that really surprised me from this book is how well paid Washington, I think some of the early initial public servants were.
And we're referring to the book by Willard Randall titled The Founder's Fortunes, How Money Shaped the Birth of America. And our guest, the Professor McGinnis, read it, reviewing it, and it's fascinating stuff about, you know, I mean, it used to be just the in the beginning, you know, during the War of Independence, America was just colonies on the East Coast. And this entrepreneurial spirit had an eye on expansion west because it was entrepreneurial, because there was money to be made there. And the railroads had a huge influence later on, that's for sure. I mean, if your town was on a railroad stop, boy, it made a huge, huge difference. Now, I had not heard of the Mount Vernon Compact before reading your essay. What was that, and how and why did it affect the switch from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution? What was the impetus that made that happen, the Mount Vernon Compact?
Well, that was connected to the Potomac Company that I've just described, that the Mount Vernon Compact was trying to settle that. And then it became one of the examples of the problems that were under the Articles of Confederation. Generally, the Articles of Confederation were thought to have two problems. One was national defense, that you really didn't have any place for an army, and you just had to ask the states to contribute, and that creates kind of free rider problem. But the other was that it didn't prevent states, as in this case, from putting up all sorts of barriers to trade. And this was an example of that states wanted their cotton, couldn't quite agree on who was going to get a greater cut between Maryland and Potomac. And that was thought to be problematic, and maybe we needed a national government to regulate commerce, and so to make it to make sure that these kind of parochial interests, each state against each other, would not dominate and prevent important commercial opportunities.
And of course, during the Civil War, there were those states in the South that wanted a primacy of states over the federal government. But, you know, some sort of an interstate commerce had to be, it was, you know, there were people, I guess, who didn't see that. That made just a huge, huge difference, being able to have regulated, controlled, free and fair interstate commerce, sounds like.
Yes, it was important. No, so I think that the commercial nature, not only of the Revolution, but of the essentially Constitution that created it, was extremely important. I would argue, and I'm sure this will be controversial in some quarters, that it was the commercial society that really isolated slavery in a variety of ways. Wow. One, it created an ideology that made slavery seem quite an outlier, and one sees that in some of the slogans of the Republican Party, which was a free soil, free labor, free men. One of those, free labor, is all about commerce, and that was thought to, slavery was thought to be against an essential ideological presupposition of a commercial society, which people were free to sell their labor. But also because of the commercial society in the North, and actually the South had no elements still, I think, of a more feudally oriented society, the North became much, much richer, and that was crucial to winning the Civil War. The Civil War, again, if you think really replicating the Revolution in this sense, was largely a battle of logistics. And the North was just in a much better position because of its industry to win over the South. So I see, again, the commerce really not as opposed to ideals, but as actually advancing the ideals of freedom and, in some sense, making the slave society quite anomalous and therefore both ideologically embattled and starved, relatively starved of resources.
And certainly the South didn't have anywhere near the capital resources that the North had. I mean, they were industrial and, you know, that was a big factor. And while everybody has heard of the Boston Tea Party, there was a great place in Boston for psychedelic rock shows in the late 60s, but that's not the one I'm talking about, as you know. You write that it wasn't so much the tax on tea that riled up the colonists, but it was the Stamp Act, and that has a lot to do with commerce. Why was the Stamp Act so infuriating? What made the colonists so hate this law, and how did it infringe the Stamp Act, in what ways did it infringe on the economic liberty and curtail commerce?
Well, the Stamp Act required all sorts of official documents, including court documents and some contract documents, to get stamped. And to get the stamp, you had to pay the government to do that. And even worse, you had to pay them in gold or other precious metals. And that was really very difficult in the colonies because they didn't have a lot of that. Most of their commerce was based on notes that people gave, maybe commercial paper that then circulated essentially like the equivalent of dollar bills. And therefore, it was a huge impediment to doing basic things in trade. And so while the tax on tea was a precipitating factor, already the Stamp Act had really riled up the colonies, and it particularly riled up the merchants. And this is again connected to the important fact that the American Revolution was supported by people with resources. That's, we've pointed that out before. And so the British made the great mistake, I think, of alienating the middle and upper middle class in the United States by their regulations, not only tax regulations, but other kinds of regulations that made commerce harder. Another example was they said you couldn't trade. You couldn't send your goods unless on British ships. Right. Essentially giving a monopoly to British ships. And of course, once you do that, you raise the cost of transportation. And that was yet another law, sort of regulatory law, that really didn't raise money, but just helped British ship interests, that really annoyed the colonists.
Yeah, I can imagine it annoyed them. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Professor John McGinnis, professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University, who wrote an essay called The Mother's Milk of Revolution. It's reviewing and discussing a new book titled The Founder's Fortunes, How Money Shaped the Birth of America. And there's one thing about history is that oftentimes, myth, as you know, stands in place of real history. People vastly prefer to believe myth than more complicated, more nuanced history. And you say, as you say, the commercial republic created by the Constitution reflects the commercial origins of the revolution. And to some people, that may be a divergence from the common understanding. What do you think this common understanding has been, and what's been inaccurate about that? Please explain what you mean.
Well, I think it depends. I think many historians have seen Mr. Willard is not the first person to see, Mr. Randall, I'm sorry, is not the first person to have seen that the commerce had something to do with the American revolution. There are many historians who understood that. I think some people may have the view that it's all about democracy. It's all about voting. And there was something about that. I mean, certainly there was a concern about lacking representation in the British Parliament. No taxation without representation was an important slogan for the colonists. And so I don't want to say that the idea of having some sort of representation in at least decisions about taxes, because actually there was a debate about whether that actually carried over to regulatory decisions, whether you needed to have a representation. But that idea of representation was important. But I think that's absolutely correct. But it doesn't tell the full story, because it's representation about what? It's representation, really, not about... the reason for the representation was they thought Britain was trampling on their economic freedom. Right. So economic freedom was also very important at the time of the revolution. It wasn't just an accident that they were worried about representation. They were worried about representation in a particular way, about taxes, to some extent about economic regulation. And so that's another aspect of the story. So it's not really false, I think, what many people believe. It's just not a full picture unless we understand the importance of commerce and economic freedom at the beginning. So it's not a surprise, though, to think about what kind of society we have today. We don't have simply a democracy in the ancient sense, where we're only concerned about voting. And whatever people vote on, you know, vox populi, vox dei, we have a liberal democracy. And a liberal democracy is one that suggests that at least we have some rights that aren't at the sufferance of our fellow citizens. And right from the beginning, I think it's fair to say that some of this idea of liberalism wasn't bound up so much with some of the things we think of as rights, but of economic rights. Indeed, in a famous essay talking about what we think of as rights, free speech, Madison analogizes them to what he sees as a, as I think he thinks his listeners will think of as a more core right, your right to property, and says, well, this is lie. You have a property in your opinions. You have a property in your beliefs. And so you should be protected just as much as in your physical property. So that's the right that's thought to be essential at the time, and which other rights build off. And sometimes I think that is forgotten today.
Interesting. And I think it's reasonably well known, or at least it's a good story, that in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was originally life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, I believe.
And that's right. That's right. And happiness, I thought, was thought to be a more encompassing term. But that does not mean that people didn't that property rights were not an important element of what most people believed at the time. The idea of sort of an egalitarian or social democracy just really wasn't present. I don't even think, actually, I may disagree with you, that's so present in Lincoln. It's becomes more present as the 19th century goes on. And, of course, the idea of equality as giving people some rights to what I would call claim rights on society as opposed to negative rights. Don't let the government do anything to you. Becomes an important aspect of politics as it surely is today. It's not so important at the revolutionary times. They or even in Jeffersonian democracy, because the great fear then is, again, you have to think of it in their terms, not our terms. The government that they knew, the government in Europe, didn't help the poor. It was a way of giving more resources to the rich, to the nobles, and protecting their privileges. And so that's the mindset of people towards government. They don't see government at that time as something that's actually going to be helping the people. That comes naturally once then the people become in control of the government. And some people say, well, then the government's actually going to advance the interests of the people vis-a-vis the rich, vis-a-vis some other group. That becomes a plausible idea, still, I think, a controversial idea, not one that I entirely subscribe to. But it becomes a plausible idea, but only becomes a plausible idea once you've actually moved to a more full-blown democracy and aren't thinking sort of the last war, which is the war against the government as kings and nobles who are in it for themselves.
Yeah, it's it was quite different, and you have to see it in the perspective that the people did at the time. And one of the there's been so much, you know, adjustments and changes and twists and turns in American history. I think of events like the Shays and Whiskey Rebellions. And this came out, of course, of the war for independence. The creditors who funded the war looked to the debtors to pay them back. The farmers and merchants, if I understand it correctly, were not too happy to go along with that. What about this populist tradition in American history? Is that something that, well, it was way back then, but what about...
Yes, absolutely. So it's great that you bring that up, because of course we might be in a populist moment today, and at that time there was, it even got to rebellion, maybe because it was a little harder to express that populism at the ballot box, while the Constitution itself was ratified by most white men did not have many property qualifications. Day-to-day politics still in many states had substantial property qualifications, not only for who could vote, but even more substantial property qualifications for who could hold office. That in some sense was the kind of anti-bribery idea, because they feared that if you didn't have a lot of money, right, you'd be very susceptible to bribery. And so that may have made it harder to express these kind of populist sentiments in ordinary politics. And one of the hard issues, I think, for any liberal democracy is how you allow the expression of those populist sentiments, yet have some breaks, because of populism is in some pretty deep sense in tension with liberalism, because populism is the idea, well, we the people, we can ride over your rights and for our overriding goals. And that's and that can be true of populists of the right and populists of the left. And in our present condition, I think we see both of them. And it's for someone like me who's lived a while in the United States, it's to me a troubling development, the rise of populism.
Yeah, it can be messy, that's for sure. It's not anywhere as neat as a liberal democracy. And
and yet we need to give some vent to it, because unless you have a structure of government that can bend, it will break. And so it's a complicated matter to get that balance right.
And it seems like we've been trying to get that balance right for a couple hundred, maybe 250 years thereabouts, that and bending a little bit. You know, I mean, there was the whole prairie populist tradition, and now the Trumpists consider themselves populists, and it's got to.
But you also have on the left, you have. I think it's absolutely fair to see Bernie Sanders as a populist.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's not confined to the right or to the left. And that's what makes it interesting. I think we've seen that before. I mean, we had seen in the New Deal, there were some left-wing populists. There was Father Coughlin.
Oh, yes.
Who might have been understood as a kind of right-wing populist.
Yes.
But it's a turbulent time.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we got Americans like Huey Long, who is a populist. It's a long tradition, and, you know, they have an influence. And, you know, one of the, I think, beauties of our liberal democracy, the system, is that, you know, there is give and take. You hear the people. It's not a direct participatory democracy. That ain't going to happen. It would, you know, it'd be anarchy. But, listening, bending, and growing underneath it all, you know, it seems like the commerce that people were interested in, property, their property, whether it be intellectual property or actual land, people are interested in protecting their property. And it's largely worked out well for most of America. I mean, there are a lot of people, not that many people to my left, who are anti-capitalist. I am not one of them. I think it's worked. It needs adjustment from time to time. It needs checks and balances from time to time. But it does seem like the struggle for economic fairness is baked into the cake that is America, wouldn't you say?
The way I would put it is, I think, certainly think now it's baked into liberal democracy, because the fact is, there's this great difficulty with liberal democracy, which is democracy gives everyone kind of an equal vote, and so equality before the law. So that's true. Liberalism gives everyone freedoms, and that is a real creates tensions because people are not equal in all sorts of ways. So they are, going right back, Adams points out that when he goes to a foundry, John Adams, a foundling, an orphanage, he says, well, he looks at different babies, and he says, well, these people are already unequal. They're very different natural endowments. And I think anyone who's seen children recognizes that. And so once you give freedom to people who begin with unequal endowments, they're going to have very different results. And that means you're going to have a society that is in some sense democratically built on an idea of equality, but on freedom, we get with just the exercise of freedoms, a very dramatically unequal society, not only in terms of resources, but in terms of some people eloquent, therefore they have a lot of influence in that way. Other people are not eloquent. And that's just a huge tension. And I don't see that ever going away so long as we have liberalism and democracy. And how we navigate that is hard. It may be becoming harder because actually the opportunities in a technological society for people to use their freedom to create ends for themselves has never been greater. That may explain why, you know, we see these very large fortunes that get, you know, some people very exercised because they seem they are extremely unequal. So that's to me is the problem, and I just don't see it going away unless we either kill liberalism or kill democracy.
Yeah, I'd prefer not to do either one, I must say. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're looking at some of the roots of how we got here. Our guest today is Professor John O. McGinnis, professor of constitutional law, who's written an essay titled "The Mother's Milk of the Revolution," and it's about money and commerce. And you know, people, refugees come here, immigrants come here because they want freedom. People have an ideal of freedom, and I mean, economic freedom, it's got to be part of it. If you don't have some degree of economic freedom, what kind of freedoms do you have? So I think it's true that everybody wants to be part of this commerce and, you know, benefiting from the commercial structure that we have here. And theoretically, we all have a capability of participating in that. And that's what our founders, it seems like, intended to create and actually seems to have done pretty well. And you say any discussion of the role of money in the early republic must come to grips with Charles Beard's claim that wealthy founders shaped the Constitution to benefit themselves, particularly by assuring that their federal bonds would be paid off. Please explain.
Well, Charles Beard, is a famous historian, in some sense, tried to debunk the founders at the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s. And his theory was that in some ways, maybe I'm being a little sharp in this way, the Constitution was a kind of stitch-up that was motivated by the fact that without the Constitution, the credit worthiness of the United States was going way down, and the bonds, which of course were held by many of the relatively wealthy people who attended the Philadelphia Convention, would be lost in value, and therefore they needed to create something that was friendlier to creditors and less friendly to debtors than some of the states. And that showed that they were, the Constitution, far from being a public-spirited document, was one that reflected the narrow self-interest of those who wrote it. Well, there have been thought to be two problems with that. One, I think, is in some sense the less problem. One fellow named Forrest MacDonald, another great historian, much more recently, died, I'd say 10, 15 years ago, went and looked and said, well, actually, the people who went to the convention, some of them had bonds, a lot of them had bonds, but they didn't amount to all that much. Seems unlikely that they were just focusing on the bonds. It was not as if that was their main source of income or didn't bulk very large. So that's number one. Number two, I would say that it doesn't follow that because you're concerned that bonds aren't being paid off, that you're not worried about something other than your narrow self-interest. It's a society which is not paying off its bonds is one where people aren't going to lend money. And that's going to be very bad for commerce and very bad for economic growth. And that's certainly my perspective. My perspective is that economic growth has just been amazing for the United States. Again, I'm old enough to look at the different cars, either my parents or now that I own, and they've all, I guess they all could be called cars, but they bear very little resemblance to one another. And this is just extraordinarily, and I think also now costing less, at least as a percentage of someone's working income today. So this is all, and then you spoke about immigration, and there's just no doubt the reason most people here, want to come to the United States. Is not. I mean, some of them, of course, are refugees. They're eager to speak freely, but most of them want to come here because we've got the institutions that make their human capital more valuable when they cross our border. Yeah. And that's an economic. It's, again, it's not politics, which is our institutions that, of course, create sustain an economic, a commercial society, but it's that commercial society that they want to come to. And I think it's important to note that we have a net, I think, migration from almost every nation in the world. I think there was some question in my mind whether New Zealand, maybe more people go to New Zealand from the United States than the other way around, but almost everywhere. And it's not only the very poor people who come here. It's middle class and indeed affluent people because they think there's an opportunity to do better in the United States. And it's overwhelmingly economic reason. So that engine of commerce is still working. It's still working for us today because unlike societies elsewhere, China, one of our great advantages vis-a-vis China is we have net migration, and we're not going to be a dwindling society. We have people of energetic, of talent from all over the world. And so the commercial society is very connected to our being a society of immigrants, which I think is good. I mean, I think we probably need to have a structure where it's done by law rather than just by volition of anyone who wants to come. But I think it's extremely important.
Yeah, it is important. That is no question why people want to be here. And there's also no question, I mean, Marxism has failed, you know? I mean, it's a lovely ideal, but it just hasn't worked where ours, frankly, has. I know I'll bother some people on my left with that, but I think, you know, that's the reality, and I would argue for that. You close your essay with this observation, Professor McGinnis. Equalizing wealth would have made it easier for the British state to lord over colonists. In our own time, when there is renewed hostility toward the rich, that is a lesson to remember. Do tell.
Well, so I'm writing a book, Why Democracy Needs the Rich, and I think the rich play an important role in people of independent means. Not only, of course, you could make an obvious argument, they make a lot of important entrepreneurial contributions and investing decisions that are extremely important for economic growth, but they do a lot of other things. One point I think is important to remember that they often take on causes that are not very popular, but that are important to get on the public agenda and that make a big difference. It's wealthy people who are crucial to funding the abolition movement. They're important to the civil rights movement. And it's easy for us to say, well, of course, those are very sound movements, but they weren't very popular when they began. And it's also the case that there's a kind of virtuous circle that much of the great art in our museum has come from wealthy donations. And it's not the case, I think, that we could short circuit that by having the government decide what art to buy.
Yeah,
I don't think much great art has been determined by bureaucratic committees. And so that's a contribution to civilization. It's also the case that they're very important in civic associations, maybe more so now when we have a world where it's all of our possibilities of different kinds of entertainment make it hard for people just to create a society just by volunteering their time. So So a lot of things that the wealthy do, again, this is not an argument that the wealthy shouldn't be taxed at differential rates.
Right.
Or that may well be true. But there's a new species of argument against the wealthy, is that they're a real problem for democracy, and we really need to kind of eliminate them get rid of their wealth because they're an extra now. They really harm democracy, and I think that's a mistaken idea that I want to be against. And of course, the revolution itself shows, at least at that very different time, the wealthy played a important, and at least in the United States, a very constructive role in our beginnings.
Yes, 'twas ever thus. Well, very interesting discussion. It's so good to look at history to try to understand it. Not enough of that goes on, in my opinion. Our guest today on Keeping Democracy Alive has been John McGinnis, professor of constitutional law at Northwestern University and contributing editor at Law and Liberty. And if you're interested, dear listener, go ahead, click on Law and Liberty. Interesting stuff there. The book that you're working on now, Why Democracy Needs the Rich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Very interesting and entertaining as well.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.